Hey everybody, it's Andy Dare here, and due to popular demand, I am posting the four segments that we have up on YouTube of the Fleecast interview with Steve Albini. This dates back to February 2011, and it's a great chat. I think we have lost the complete interview, but we do have these four segments that are up on the YouTube channel FleeVids. So I thought, why not combine them and bring you a 30-minute chunk excerpts from our Fleecast podcast. This is episode 301, dating back February 2011, with special guest Steve Albini. I want to thank the co-Fleecasters, Drew Trilla, Ryan Trembath, and producer Adam. And check out youtube.com/FleeVids. Here, without further ado, is the bits and pieces of the Fleecast interviewing Steve Albini at Lovely Electrical Audio in Chicago, Illinois. Enjoy.
I had a question. Yeah, I've heard you say, in a few interviews that you're big on capturing a band sound, how they really are. And so I was wondering if you had anything resembling a standard mic setup, or is it wildly different each time?
Well, I mean, it's not wildly different each time, but I like to think that I'm suiting the setup to the band. I like to give each band credit for having a distinctive personality and trying to suit things to the band. I also have a thing that I picked up from Bob Weston. Bob Weston is the bass player in the band I'm in, Shellac. He's also a recording engineer, and he confided in me at one point. He said he liked to keep his sessions interesting even when the band wasn't interesting, so he always forced himself to do one thing he'd never done before on every session.
That's cool.
And I've taken to doing that as well. Like, regardless of what the session is, I try to find one thing that I've never done before and do it as an experiment so that I'll know what it's like. And then it's just sort of a way to adult education, nice. Broaden your vocabulary,
Expanding the palette.
Would you kind of say that your mic placement is painstakingly detailed, or do you pretty
much
have it down?
Well, I mean, I like to be accurate with what I'm doing. I like to do things in a consistent way so that I'm not, just fucking around in the dark. I like to know what I'm doing. So I do have, there are situations that come up pretty regularly. Like, if you want a big booming bass drum, then you need to have the physical bass drum set up in a certain way, and the acoustics of the room need to be sympathetic, and then you need to use mics that are sympathetic for that. If you want a very dry, very staccato, very tight, very focused bass drum sound, well, that's a whole different kettle of fish. The bass drum needs to be set up differently. You need to use different mics. You probably need a different acoustic environment. Everything flows from what the expectation of the band is on the sound of their record. Mm-hmm. And you have to be aware of what the changes you make as an engineer are going to imply for that final sound. So the important thing is to have a conversation with the band before you get started. What do you want this to sound like? And get them to describe it in whatever language they can. Sometimes they'll make reference to other records, either records that I've done or records that they've liked that I might be familiar with. Sometimes they'll just make noises with their mouth, I had one guy describe his bass drum. He said he wanted his bass drum to sound like somebody slapping a ham with a catcher's mitt, And that's a pretty good description.
Yeah, you get an image in your head.
Exactly. Yeah. You can pick out what he's shooting for there. That's what the key to the whole thing is, to be open-minded about what you think is a good idea, and so that you're not trying to shoehorn every session into some preconceived sonic architecture or whatever, but so that you're, when the band comes in, they say they want their record to sound a certain way, you get it close as damn it to that. Before you start fiddling with anything, for the very first thing that you try to do is to try to satisfy the band and get them in the ballpark of what they want their record to sound like. And then if you make adjustments from there, those should be adjustments that you're making at the direction or with the approval of the band. It's not, I'm not comfortable with the idea that I know what music should sound like. I don't think I'm that smart. I don't think I'm necessarily, and I also don't think that my tastes are universal. Like, I like a lot of really fucked up records, right? So, and my bands have sort of historically made kind of noisy,
abrasive music,
obscene, you know, ugly music, and I'm stimulated by that on a personal level. Mm-hmm. Like the insult of some of my favorite records is my favorite thing about them, you know. So if I tried to apply that aesthetic to every band that walked through the door, you know, Pretty Happy Strum Girlfriend, yada yada, pop song type band that comes in, and I tried to make their record sound like Exploding Hell, you know, it wouldn't satisfy them. It wouldn't be sympathetic to the aesthetics of the band. It certainly wouldn't give them what they were expecting or what they wanted, and it wouldn't be any better than what they would have gotten on their own. Like, it's like a lose-lose scenario if I were to try to apply my aesthetics to every band that walk in through the door.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty level-headed approach and makes sense, kind of almost common sense. But it's funny, I've had experience at some of the other, like, big studios in Chicago, and they had the almost exact opposite approach. You know,
like, oh, this is what we use for the bass, that kind of thing.
They put their fingerprints out. On everything.
Yeah. Yeah, like, you know, I know, for example, one mic I think I've heard you say you detest is the 57, right?
Well, yeah,
I'm not a huge fan of it.
Yeah, it's kind of a crappy mic. Like, I think everybody would admit that the SM57 is kind of a crappy mic.
Right.
But they're $80, and they're very, like, you know, they have an identifiable and consistent sonic signature. Like, everybody's familiar with them. So they're a go-to mic for a lot of people who don't have a lot of other choices sometimes.
Yeah, and I've seen a studio owner use that mic on every session for the snare drum for, you know, wildly different types of groups, and I always thought that was kind of bogus.
Yeah, well, keep
the client happy, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of reasons for that. I mean, I don't know why that. Maybe that microphone is special to him because, you know, he murdered his wife with it, and so it's his way of, like.
I think he's just getting old and lazy.
Yeah,
I'll tell you who it is after the.
There's that as well, but like the main thing is when a band comes in to the studio, I assume that they have their aesthetic sort of knitted together already, that they already know what they want their band to sound like. They've already written the songs. They've already decided who's going to play bass, you know, things like that. They've got it worked out pretty much.
Yeah.
So my job is not to tear any of that shit apart and put it back together with tweezers. My job is to allow them to have as seamless of movement through the intestine of the studio, so that when out poops their music on the other end, it's precisely digested in the manner that they want it
it's
to
very
be.
Very healthy, right? Movement. Yeah.
Exactly. No hang-ups, you know, no spraying, just like. So, and that comes from, I'm convinced that comes from my experiences being part of the band and music culture during the punk rock era, when bands were very strong-willed, very hard-headed about what they wanted to do and what they wanted to sound like and what kind of music they wanted to make. I was like that. All of my friends were like that. It was I saw that as normal for a band to be, like, almost belligerent about what the kind of music they wanted to make. And all these, like, strong-willed, uncompromising people made amazing records, you know? So I felt like the proof was in the pudding there. Like, if you have a bunch of strong-willed people who know precisely what they want, and they will, you know, and they will take absolutely no guff from anybody and compromise not at all, and the end result of that is you make all these awesome records, well, then that's a worthwhile working method. You know, see, the results definitely speak to that being a good working method. So I respect that on that level. But more importantly, I got to see a band, like bands that were friends of mine, go into the studio, those rare occasions in the 70s or early 80s when a band would get to go into a studio. And the record that came out didn't bear that much relationship to the band that went in. Like, it didn't sound familiar to me. Like, you know, I know these guys. I see them a lot, and this They're record doesn't like sound like that. Yeah. And it ends up being that, you know, they get to the studio, and the engineer says, well, you know, your guitar amp kind of sucks. Maybe you should use this nice guitar amp that we've got here. This one's really nice. You want to use this? It's really nice.
Yeah. Enticing them. Yeah.
You know, and like, oh, that sounds all distorted and noisy. Why don't I clean that up for you a little bit? You know, stuff like that. Yeah. And so these bands, like, just inch by inch, they got shifted away from the things that made them distinctive from all other bands, and got shifted more toward the sort of standard presentation of music for the era. And I always saw that as a negative thing. Like, I very seldom did a band go into the studio and come out with a record that was greater than them. It happened on rare, rare occasions, but the great vast majority of the time, the band would come in, go into the studio, and to the degree that the record differed from them as people and as a band, it sucked.
Yeah, and, too many cooks in the kitchen, kind of.
Well, I don't. You never know what the processes are that go on behind closed doors. Like, you don't really know what arguments were had. But the end result of it was the record didn't represent the band very well, and it sucked as a result. But then, like, a band would go into the studio with a sympathetic engineer. Like, a couple of good examples would be the Effigies going into the studio with Tim Powell, or Naked Raygun going into the studio with Ian Burgess, and the records that came out were very, very reminiscent to the band. Like, whoa, that's exactly what Earl's guitar sounds like when you see him in the Effigies. Or, yeah, that's exactly what Jim Kaleo's drum kit sounds like when you see Naked Raygun. Like, and you'd hear those records, and those records would be, like, awesome, fantastic records. And the common trait, like, the bands stylistically weren't very similar, but the thing that was consistent between them was that both of those records sounded faithful to the band. They didn't sound different than I expected them to. They sounded exactly like I expected them to, and that was awesome.
Okay, well, I had kind of a full circle question. We started off the podcast, and you were talking about the scene in the early 90s, late 80s. What are your thoughts on the local scene now?
It's a lot more fragmented now. Like,
yes.
There used to be, like, a small number of venues that almost all different kinds of bands would play at, and so the bands were very fraternal, and even bands that weren't stylistically that close to each other would often, like, share a rehearsal space or, like, be comrades in one way or another, like, work at the same bar or whatever. And now it seems like because the things like the internet make it possible for you to stay entirely within your own interests all day, every day, there's less cross-pollination than there was in the 80s and 90s. It seems like bands are interacting with each other less and they tend to stick to themselves more.
Yeah, we started playing shows downtown a few years ago, and I was really surprised that we weren't able to hop right into a scene. It's just like, you know, bands don't even seem to be that interested in getting that going.
Yeah, it seems like there's less of a fraternity of musicians than there was. A lot of it had to do with, like, there were these kind of groups of bands that were, like, sort of regional, like, you know, all these bands from this neighborhood or all these bands from this neighborhood or whatever, and they would hang out at the same bars and they would, like, interact with each other, you know, fuck each other's girlfriends, that kind of thing. Like, there was more of a social network of bands as peers, right? Now it seems very much like bands are, well, to a greater degree, it seems like bands are kind of defining themselves, staking out their territory, and this is us, and this is, you know, we're soldiers against the world or whatever the hell it is. And so, like, bands are, it seems like they're being a lot more, like, insular and a lot more isolated from each other.
Yeah, I think
it's
that's
kind
too
of
bad.
Ironic because now it's a lot more popular with the social networking stuff.
Yeah, but the
back
thing
then, you didn't have that.
Right. Well, that's the point, is that back then you had to bump into a lot of people in order to find your friends, and now, because of all the internet connectivity, you can have friends all over the world without ever leaving your room, you know, and you're only ever, you, if you choose to only ever interact with people who are on World of Warcraft and also into, like...
hentai or something, yeah.
Yeah, or vegan necromancy or whatever, then you can pretty much sculpt your life so that you only ever interact with those people. It's a very narrow thing,
very true,
you know. It's quite possible. But that didn't used to be the case, so you used to have to rub elbows more. When I first came to Chicago in 1980, and I got involved in the music scene here, the thing that struck me most about the music scene and the thing that made it seem so important to me was that the punk scene at the time was a completely unfiltered cross-section of the part of the spectrum of humanity that didn't fit in anywhere, right? So you have all the professional people and college students and, you know, comfortable family people and people settled in their lives. And then you have the faggots and the petty criminals and the dope fiends and the, you know, the guys just out of jail and the recent immigrants and the runaways and, the, you know, you have like this, all these people who don't have any connection, don't have any foothold in the real world. And all of those people were represented in the punk scene. Like, you would see, like, actual for real petty criminals and prostitutes and dope fiends and college professors and, like, Dungeons and Dragons geeks and, like, you just, like, the strangest fucking collection of people you can imagine. People, you know, mildly schizophrenic people, you know, Asperger's syndrome spectrum people. Like, that was the fraternity of the punk rock scene was all of these people who didn't have a fucking hope anywhere else. Like, that was it. That was their entire scene was going to be all these other people that couldn't cope, you know? Mm-hmm. And it seemed like it validated that whole end of the spectrum to me. It seemed like it made all of these, like, unwanted and unlikable people, you know, it took them seriously. It made them legitimate. And that's why, I mean, and I felt totally comfortable, totally at home there. I was kind of a loner, outsider, weirdo, geek, and I felt, like, comfortable in the music scene in Chicago, in the punk scene. And I think as music has progressed and evolved, there really hasn't been a need for a catch-all idiom anymore, you know? And it seems like everybody is now can sort of comfortably slot into subgenres, whereas wasn't right. really the case then. And like I said, people had to work a lot harder to make friendships and peer relationships, because you literally physically had to go out and meet people in order to do it, you know?
Actually get out there.
Well, that's a real depressing note to end on. But
I don't know.
We try to do the same thing, though. We stay at the streets.
No,
I have to say, though, I mean, having seen the music scenes in other cities, like in other parts of the world and in other parts of the country, Chicago is still an order of magnitude more collaborative and more cooperative and more fraternal than places like New York or London or Zurich or whatever. Like, those places, people really are hived off into separate little warrens and will never see each other and never meet, you know, never interact with each other. Chicago is still an order of magnitude better than those places.
Is that sort of why you set up shop in Chicago? I know you went to Northwestern, but I mean, is that...
I mean, it was kind of an accident that I ended up here, because I went to school at Northwestern, and when I finished college, I just stayed here. It's kind of an accident, but I can't think of a better place. You know, it's a totally great city on every level. It's huge. There's an enormous diversity of people. There's good food here, you know. The infrastructure of the city is not really that supportive of the music scene. Like, we talked before the Tascam was rolling about the way the bar scene was set up. Like, the city makes it very difficult to open a bar with live music. And I think part of that is done because I think part of that is due to the influence of some of the churches that, you know, see alcohol as a bad thing. And part of it is influence of people who own liquor licenses now, that they're scarce, means that they're printing money hand over fist, and that's really good for them, and they have a lot of political influence. Mm-hmm. So there are things structurally about the city that make it kind of awkward, but if there's anything that's true about Chicago is that everybody finds a way to get by. You know, like you always, you know, there are a lot of basements here, so there's almost always a place to practice. There are a lot of bungalows, and bungalows have basements, and that means that there are places to practice, you know. And so bands will always be able to find a place to practice, at either at a rented house or at a friend's house or whatever. And there aren't that many places to play in Chicago, but there are some places to play, and people can always put together makeshift gigs and stuff. So there's a lot of stuff that you can do in Chicago that's much more difficult in a smaller town, and there's a lot of stuff that you can do in Chicago that for whatever reason is frowned on in more cosmopolitan cities like Los Angeles and New York. You know, you just don't get the sort of feeling of friendliness or openness in those cities.
I was wondering what your current relationship was like with Kim Deal, and then going back a little bit further, after Pod was so well-received, why were you passed up, or did she pass you up for Last Splash, and then, you know, you also went on to record Tuttle TK and Mountain Battles?
Well, on a personal level, we get along great. Kim and I knew Kim when she was in the Pixies, we got along then. I knew her when she started the Breeders, which was kind of like a... at the time, kind of a semi-serious band that was more of her taking a break from Pixies' responsibilities and doing something on her own. And that's when they did Pod. And then the band lineup changed, and a whole bunch of things happened where Kim sort of started taking the Breeders more seriously personally. Her personal life got a lot more crazy. She got Kelly, her sister, involved, and that was like sort of a conceptual thing from the beginning that never took place until she had time on her hands. I guess the Pixies were on a break or the Pixies broke up. I don't remember the timeline of this whole bullshit. But basically, she had a much more complicated thing going on when she did the second Breeders proper album.
Okay.
There was a whole lot more bullshit for her to deal with. And I think... but I'm not sure because she's never actually said this out loud, but I think that she wanted to see if she could do that management of that on her own without having any people from her prior,
the old days
involved. Right. So then after that, there was a sort of a fallow period where, you know, she had some personal problems. She was living in several different places in the country. She put a whole band together. That band turned into Dope Fiends and disappeared on her. Mm-hmm. She tried to record a record. She basically recorded a whole bunch of stuff and then scrapped it after, you know, wasting a couple $100,000. Mm-hmm. And she was dejected about it all. Then she got back together with her sister, and her sister started working on stuff more seriously. And she found these musicians that she wanted to play with. And so she got them together to, like, sort of reignite the Breeders as a band, and that was a very good, very productive thing for her. Mm-hmm. And I think she wanted to do something, like, she wanted me involved basically because she liked the way that record had come out that I had worked on, and she hadn't been having a lot of luck in the interim, so she sort of thought, well, let's give it another shot with Steve. And at that point, we sort of rekindled our friendship, and we've remained very good friends.
Because I knew you well, recording Mountain Battles, 3 years ago now, but also I saw you on the 2005, the Pixies documentary, Loud, Quiet, Loud, and I think it was the bonus feature, actually. You were just hanging out with Kim, so that was pretty cool.
I believe you. I haven't seen that, so I don't...
You were telling a joke about bees or something. I can't remember the exact context.
Is it the guy that keeps the bees in a shoebox?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it was
love
on the
that
bonus
joke.
Features, but it was you guys were laughing and having a good time, so I knew...
No, we get along well. She, I mean, like, her and her sister are... in a small way, kind of extended family for me and my wife. Like, we've done a lot of stuff together. We've gone places together and hung out together a lot.
Nice.
That's cool.
Growing up a fan of the Stooges, what was it like to work with them in 2007 on The Weirdness?
Awesome.
Yeah.
Like, the greatest thing ever. Like, the Stooges were very important band to me when I was, like, maturing as a music listener. The first band that I really got into as a fan was the Ramones. Like, they were the band that sort of got me excited about listening to music in the first place. Once I started listening to music seriously, by seriously, I mean, you know, like, listening to records over and over and buying records because I like the bands and stuff. I very quickly found the Stooges record because a lot of people were recommending that if you like the Ramones, you'd love the Stooges. So I those first two Stooges albums are amazing. But Raw Power is less of an important record to me. Funhouse is a kind of a definitive record to me. Like, I think in one way or another, I've been trying to make a record like Funhouse as long as I've been making records, both being in a band and in the studio. Funhouse is like the pinnacle of the rock achievement as far as I'm concerned. Like, if I had to listen to one record again over and over for the rest of my life, it would probably be Funhouse, right? So
that's the goal. That's like the
yeah, that's like if
head.
You can ever make a record that good, then you win,
yeah.
You know?
How does that work?
Oh, what I was going to say was, like, just getting the phone call, like, how would you like to work on a Stooges record, was like, okay, go ahead and kill me now, that's fine, you know. And then spending a month in the studio with the Stooges was exactly precisely what you would want it to be like. Like, as a fan, as somebody who for whom the Stooges, like, meant something, right? You want Iggy Pop to be this, like, totally lusty, like, you know, really living life to the full, like, completely horny, like, really active, really dynamic guy. You want him to, like, totally take over the room when he walks in.
Take the shirt
and he
off.
Does,
yeah.
You know? He's always shirtless, like, you know, like,
veins popping out.
Yeah, you know.
That's cool.
You know, four takes, five takes, whatever. He's 100% on the mic every single time. Like, you know, like, the band, he sang everything live with the band because that was the way they always did it back in the day, and that's the way he wanted to do it again. So he, you know, he was giving 100% on every take, singing with the band, you know, and if they blew the take halfway through, it didn't bother him. You know, I get to do it again, you know.
That's awesome.
And, you know, and Ron Ashton, you want his guitar to just be like this totally, like, explosive thing that just, like, sounds like a machine. And it was. He was exactly like that. He was really, like, zeroed in on what his guitar was supposed to sound like, and he sounded great. And you want Scott to be this, like, immovable object. He's like the, you know, he's just like this totally steady, like
anchors it all,
unperturbable, like, completely, you could shoot at him, you know, you could throw buckets of water at him and it would never stop, it would never deviate, it would never stop. That's what you want him to be like, and he's totally like that, you know, completely 100% grounded, settled. That's him, you know. I don't know, it was just it was a really amazing culmination to me to be able to work on a record like that. I don't really give a shit what anybody thinks about the record. I don't really give a shit whether that record is any good or not, even. All I care about, in all honesty, just the fact that I got to work on a Stooges record was such an amazing thing for me. Every day I'd get up and my wife would say, remember that time you got to go make a record with the Stooges? And I'd be like, yeah, that was awesome. Oh, wait, that's today, you know? And I'd go downstairs and spend the day with the fucking Stooges in my own house. How cool is that?
That is ridiculously, you know? Awesome.
Was that, like, really trippy the first moment when you met him?
I kind of shit my pants a little bit. I tried to keep it together, but it was pretty amazing meeting and hanging out with those guys. It was pretty incredible. I'm actually, you know, I like the record they made. I was proud of it.
Oh, it's strong.
Yeah. They there was a minor detail at the end of the very end of the ball game that was kind of a drag. Iggy was mastering the record at Abbey Road, and this mastering session was the morning after they had just finished playing a gig in London. So, like, they, you know, play this totally deafening show, walk off stage, you know, barely have a chance to get showered and go to bed and get up, and then he's got to make all these critical decisions about the mastering of the record. So I have a feeling that the mastering on the record is a little bit overcooked, and it probably, like, the final sound quality isn't probably as close to his ideal as it should have been. So, but that was just an awkwardness that was unavoidable because of the deadlines and when they had to do it.
The second part to that question I was going to say is, you know, did you call them or they called you? But you said they called you. I mean, you know, what's that like, getting a call from them?
It's awesome.
How does that even come about?
The phone rings and you pick it up, and on the other end, actually, I got an email, and then I got a phone call, and then I spent some time talking to Iggy about, like, he talked to me for a while about records that he liked, some stuff that I had worked on and some stuff that other people had worked on, and he asked me if I would send him some samples of some things I'd recorded, and I don't know why, but in particular, he wanted to hear stuff that I had done with acoustic instruments and female voices, which I thought was kind of odd, but, you know, fine with me. So I made a little CD of some stuff that I had worked on over the years, and I sent it to him. And we corresponded a little bit and talked on the phone a little bit, and then eventually they showed up and made a record, and it was awesome.
It's really cool. I think it's interesting that he's involved in the mastering process, too.
He's very much involved in every stage of the... Like, the Stooges were important to him, as they were probably, like... His solo career was basically what he, you know, how he paid the bills. But I think the Stooges was sort of like his baptism by fire, you know, and I think he respects that as where he came from, you know.
I'm surprised that Abbey Road would let anything come out of their mastering studio that was, you know, anything less than they thought was stellar. But I'm sure.
Well, they're a studio like any place else. I mean, I've worked on shitty records, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I've worked on good records and I've worked on shitty records, and it's not always, it's not really. I'm not. I don't think that there's anybody that has to ultimately say, you know, no, this will not pass. I'm sorry, you know.
That's true.
It's just,
I guess,
like, whatever the end result of the session is, when the time allotted runs out, that's what you've got.
You'd have to have some nerve to tell Iggy, I don't really like this mix too much.
But also, like, I've worked with the people at Abbey Road in mastering enough to know that if somebody says, I want you to do this to my record, they'll do it. You know,
yeah.
Because they have the same respect for their clients that I do.
That's true. I did see a doc on their facility. It seemed like the mastering was particularly impressive.
That's my favorite mastering room in the world. Yeah. Like, they have fantastic engineers, fantastic equipment, great signal path, good monitors. Like, literally nothing to complain about there.